Thanks for tuning in for the March 19th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights a neurology clinical practice article on predictors of dementia misclassification when using brief cognitive assessments. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an interview on a randomized delayed start trial of levodopa in Parkinson's disease.
Hi, this is James Grogan from the University of Virginia. Today I'm interviewing Dr. David Llewellyn from the University of Exeter Medical School. We're going to discuss his paper published November 2018 in Neurology Clinical Practice titled Predictors of Dementia Misclassification When Using Brief Cognitive Assessments. Hey, David, thanks for joining us.
Hi, James. My pleasure.
So before we dive into your article, could you briefly describe some of the ways a general neurologist listening in can take your work and apply it to their practice and to their patient care?
Well, I think the core question that we really wanted to get at was, what if the tests that we use to identify people who have dementia are fundamentally biased? And what we've done in our paper is to ask that question in a very large cohort of people and look at the patterns across tests. And in a nutshell, what it suggests is that we do need to be cautious when using these tests, and there's definitely room for improvement.
And then as far as the population you're talking about, can you give us a little background on the patient population you're focusing on and why you wanted to focus on these three cognitive assessments? I believe you looked at the mini mental status exam, the memory impairment screen, and animal naming tests.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked with the aging demographics and memory study for some time because it's quite unique in some ways. It's nationally representative of the U.S. population. So it uses an epidemiological sampling frame, and it had a lot of in-home, very extensive assessments. But at the same time, they went to great efforts to do a proper consensus diagnosis process. And when you're talking about over 800 adults, I mean, it's quite an amazing feat, really.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's that combination of being nationally representative and being on a very large scale for this kind of study that's so appealing. Another advantage of this study for the question that we had is that it included more than one of the brief cognitive assessments that tend to be used to identify patients with dementia, or are recommended as some of the existing guidelines for which tests you should be using to identify people with dementia. So there are other tests that we would like to look at, and we're doing that in some of our ongoing research. But it's a key advantage, really, that we can, in the same population, look at the performance of these tests and the possible biases that affect performance.
Now, speaking of the biases, you examine a number of different biases reducing the diagnostic accuracy of the three target assessments. One in particular increased misclassification in all three screens, and that was the, quote, absence of informed rated poor memory. What do you mean by this?
Well, what it comes down to is when you do a brief cognitive assessment, it's often the first time you've tested people in this way, and you don't really know whether people have always been at that level or they're deteriorating in a way that would be suspicious and lead you to be more convinced that they're developing dementia. Now, if a patient comes along with someone who knows them well, often in clinical practice, you'll get their opinion when you're taking the history. And this finding was based on the impression of someone, often a family member, but sometimes it was just someone else who knew them well, like a friend. And if they're concerned about the person's cognition, then that added quite a lot of predictive power to the models. So even if they just passed, if they were, you know, above the threshold on one of these tests, if they came along with someone who was concerned, then that combination was really helpful to know.
Okay, excellent. In your report, you also mentioned the general practitioner assessment of cognition and the informant questionnaire on cognitive decline. Is there any way we can use these to formalize this informant-rated poor memory into our assessments?
Well, I think absolutely. What it suggests is that one of the key advantages of a test which formally incorporates the informant impression of the patient is that you should be helping to address the bias that is affecting the other tests that don't do that. So a key advantage of the GPCOG or the IQ code tests is that they give you a standardized way of doing that. And the GPCOG incorporates both the kind of cognitive testing and the informant report. And where it's most likely to be helpful is with the borderline cases of dementia. The people who are just above the cutoff or just below the cutoff, because that's where you tend to make most mistakes if you take the results of the tests literally. So I think it's really useful that these tools exist, and some clinicians already use these, but some don't. I think one of the real challenges here is that variation in clinical practice. Our findings inform the debate about whether you really need to do this, and I would suggest that it's a sensible thing and that it should always be something that's done if possible. Obviously, sometimes patients don't come with an informant who knows them well, in which case you have to rely on other things.
Okay. You also describe when patients have more education, they're more likely to have a normal score with the mini mental status exam, even if they had some cognitive impairment. Now, you talk about education and just a cutoff to improve the diagnostic accuracy. Do you have any recommendations about that? And how can we apply that to practicing neurologists to minimize the impact of these biases?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly important with a test like that to try and take into account education levels. We didn't find an individual cutoff in terms of education where it stopped becoming important. So every year of education seemed to be making a difference. It's not just education that's potentially biasing that test. So then we're forced into this slightly uncomfortable position where you have to use clinical judgment to help to interpret the test results and to not take them too literally. Ideally, we'd develop a formal system which enabled that information to be weighted together and improve the quality of the information given to clinicians, given these different factors and potential biases. But that's something that can't easily be done in a paper and pencil-based format, which is why we've been using machine learning approaches and advanced statistical approaches to produce algorithms to combine that kind of information. And we have a new technology called Decode, which allows clinicians to do that in real time with patients and to interpret the results of the test in a different way. And, you know, if clinicians are interested in the work we're doing in that area, they can find out more about it at decodedementia.com.
Okay. And you said that's decodedementia.com?
Yes.
Okay. Very cool. And as far as other cognitive assessments, you said that you are researching some others. And for example, how could we apply this to, say, the SLUMS or the MoCA, which are also popular in America?
Yeah, we haven't looked at data for SLUMS yet. I'd be interested to do that because it's widely used. But we have started looking at the MoCA, and we also see a similar pattern of biases, even on education, which is perhaps surprising because the scoring of the MoCA incorporates an adjustment for education. So our findings, although preliminary, suggest that this is a widespread phenomenon. We haven't looked at any one test yet which is free from bias. And I think, again, it raises this question of how do we work differently with these tests? I think we need to have a more holistic approach to thinking about the different factors that feed into test performance. It's certainly going to be a challenge, but I think it's an area that's ripe for more research.
Are there any final key points you'd like to discuss before we finish?
Well, I guess I'd just like to say that obviously identifying people who might have dementia is a really challenging task, and clinicians are doing their best. The tests that we have available at the moment are not perfect. They're structured and they're reliable in a sense, but at least we have a better idea now of the kind of biases that influence test performance. If we can develop new technologies to further enhance clinical judgment, I think that would be very useful. And ultimately, what we're trying to do, of course, is to improve the timely diagnosis of dementia so people can get more support and symptomatic treatments. And if we can get people into trials earlier, then obviously that's going to be absolutely crucial for developing disease-modifying treatments that have so far proven to be elusive. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. There's a lot of work to be done, but I think we're starting to make progress in this area, and we're really excited about continuing in this field.
That's great. This has been Dr. David Llewellyn discussing his paper titled Predictors of Dementia Misclassification When Using Brief Cognitive Assessments from Neurology to Clinical Practice, published November 2018. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, James.
Hello, this is Jason Crowell from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Rob DeBee. He is a professor of movement disorders at the University of Amsterdam. Today we're going to be discussing his recent paper published January 24th, 2019 in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Randomized Delayed Start Trial of Levodopa in Parkinson's Disease. Rob, first of all, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So I'm very excited that you did this study and are coming to talk to us about it today, because for those of us who see patients with Parkinson's disease, whether movement disorder specialist or general neurologist, this topic you're addressing, I think, can be a source of great confusion for both patients and providers. And so before we dig into the details, would you mind just saying what the headline is, what your take-home message is from this study?
I think the main take-home message is that levodopa doesn't worsen the progression of Parkinson's disease, and that early start with levodopa doesn't worsen motor response fluctuations or dyskinesias later on in the disease. I think those are the two main messages.
And so this is interesting, right? Because the question of when to start patients on levodopa has been asked for many years, and I would say with greater controversy since the L-DOPA trial, the earlier versus later levodopa therapy in Parkinson's disease trial that was published by the Parkinson Study Group in the New England Journal in 2004. And so to help lay the groundwork, would you mind kind of explaining the results of that study and why the results were maybe somewhat ambiguous or unclear?
It was really a groundbreaking study back then. In the L-DOPA trial, they randomized 360 patients in four treatment arms, and one group got placebo, and three other groups were on levodopa treatment, and each group on a different dose. And after 40 weeks, the study drug was stopped, and 2 weeks later, the severity of the Parkinson's symptoms were assessed in all patients. And surprisingly, patients that had taken levodopa had not deteriorated as much as the patients that were on placebo. So suddenly there was this notion that levodopa could be neuroprotective, but it could also be that the washout was not long enough, or even though in a small group of patients that were followed for an additional 2 weeks had the same outcome, but could be that the washout was not long enough to rule out that the results were due to a prolonged effect of levodopa on the symptoms. And also in that study, the dopamine transporter SPECT scans, so the nuclear imaging, suggested that levodopa may actually have accelerated the loss of dopamine nerve terminals. So that was contradictory to the clinical results. The authors of the L-DOPA trial concluded that the potential long-term effects of levodopa on Parkinson's disease remain uncertain. So that was their bottom line.
Great. And so, as you mentioned, there was these kind of conflicting results where patients seemed to clinically have done better, but the imaging study suggested maybe they were actually doing worse. And I think we've all heard both providers and patients who talk about wanting to, quote, hold off on starting Sinemet so as to not accelerate the progression of Parkinson's disease. And so with these questions swirling and that in mind, can you tell us about your study and its delayed start design and the results that you all found?
Yeah. So what we did, we randomized 445 drug-naive patients with early Parkinson's disease and randomized them to or 80 weeks of levodopa, carbidopa, so 100/25 milligrams 3 times per day, or to 40 weeks of placebo followed by 40 weeks of levodopa in the same dose. So if there would be a difference between the two groups at the 80 weeks time point, that would be due to a difference of treatment in the first 40 weeks. So because in the second 40 weeks, both groups were using the same dose of levodopa. Our study, so the results, did not show a statistically significant difference between the two groups regarding Parkinson's severity at 80 weeks. So what happened in the first 40 weeks did not make a difference at the end. What we also saw is that in the first 40 weeks, patients on levodopa had less Parkinson's symptoms than the patient in the placebo group. I mean, this was known and is a symptomatic effect. And they also had a better health-related quality of life, so they were less bothered by their Parkinson's symptoms. I still think that treatment with levodopa can start when patients experience difficulties in daily life. When you're in doubt about their disability, you could advise to start right away.
Right, and so this gives us some measure of confidence and reassurance that if we are starting folks on medicine when they need it because of symptoms or impairment in function, then we can have some confidence that we're not hastening any harm or accelerating the progression of their disease. And then secondly, in your study, comparing the early and late start groups, these two groups that got levodopa at different time points, was there any difference in the rate of dyskinesias between the two groups?
No. So at the end, so at the 80 weeks time point, there was no difference in dyskinesias between the groups. So the early start group did not have more dyskinesias than the patients that started later with levodopa.
And so, you know, trying to translate these results into clinic, suppose I have a patient that comes into my clinic and she has Parkinson's disease, and when I recommend adding levodopa to her regimen, she might become concerned because she's afraid it's going to hasten dyskinesias or it's going to hasten motor fluctuations. In light of your study, what would you suggest that I say to her?
So what I tell patients is that what they do now does not affect the severity of dyskinesias later on in the disease. So the dyskinesias are due to more severe disease stage in combination with characteristics of levodopa at that time point, but not what is happening at the moment.
Wonderful. I think this is very important for all practitioners to know and really gives us better insight about how to treat these early patients with Parkinson's disease and also how to counsel them if they have concerns about, you know, potential side effects of the levodopa, including motor fluctuations and dyskinesias. So I'm really glad that you guys did this study, and I hope that folks will check out the article. It's available now on the New England Journal of Medicine, published January 24th. And once again, the article is titled Randomized Delayed Start Trial of Levodopa in Parkinson's Disease. Rob, thank you so much once again for joining us to talk about this study.
Thank you very much.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting observer-blinded study on the long-term efficacy of deep brain stimulation for essential tremor, and a 44-year longitudinal population study of women on cognitive and physical activity and dementia. And don't forget to check out neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on global neurology and innovations in care delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.